Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello. In this week's programme, we discover why an extremely silly new series of children's books has landed its author a really quite serious prize. We talk to the third of the authors shortlisted for this year's Guardian First Book Award, and we lock jaws with the demon dog of American crime fiction.
The prologue.
America!
I window peeped 4 years of our history. It was one long mobile stakeout and kick the door in shakedown. I had a license to steal and a ticket to ride. I followed people. I bugged and tapped and caught big events in ellipsis. I remained unknown. My surveillance links the then to the now in a never-before-revealed manner. I was there. My reportage is buttressed by credible hearsay and insider tattle. Massive paper trails provide verification. This book derives from stolen public files and usurped private journals. It is the sum of personal adventure and 40 years of scholarship. I am a literary executor and an agent provocateur. I did what I did and saw what I saw and learned my way through to the rest of the story. Scripture pure veracity and scandal rag content. That conjunction gives it its sizzle. You carry the seed of belief within you already. You recall the time this narrative captures and sends conspiracy. I am here to tell you that it is all true and not at all what you think. You will read with some reluctance and capitulate in the end. The following pages will force you to succumb. I am going to tell you everything.
James Ellroy, reading from the prologue to his new novel, Blood's a Rover. If anyone thought my introduction was a little, well, rude, I can assure them that The Demon Dog of American Crime Fiction was the title of an American documentary made about him back in the 1990s. Blood's Rover is the final instalment of his Underworld USA trilogy, which depicts 14 years of American history from 1958 to 1972, with, as the Guardian Review pointed out, a tight focus on conspiracies, murder, madness, corruption, and racial hatred. The latest book races us over the final stretch of that period from 68 to 72. Suzanne Brooks asked him what it is that distinguishes those particular 4 years from the periods covered in the previous books.
I was more personally aware because I was older. I made a conscious decision to quit writing crime books and writing about L.A. exclusively. In no way, the Underworld USA trilogy, policiers, mysteries, cop books, thrillers. They are pure historical novels.
The one thing that's significant about this era is there's no obvious catalyst. Like, 63 had the Kennedy assassination, 68 you've got Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. Here it's more of a diffuse madness and meltdown that you're tackling.
Blood's a Rover, the third book in the trilogy, is the most fictionalized and the least reliant on established history. I do threadbare research. Researchers compile fact sheets and chronologies so that I don't write myself into error. These books largely take place in America. This book goes to the Cuban shores, the Dominican Republic, Haiti. It's 99% fiction and wholly fact. The one question I never answer, what's real and what's not?
It's interesting that you say that because this book is, you know, your work is described as, I've read, a counter-history of America, which implies that the myth and the fact are muddled in together. Do you think that that was a kind of hallmark of that time anyway?
This is pre-public accountability America, pre-Watergate America. This book, which stands as the chronological conclusion of my life's work as a historical novelist, begins before
ends, excuse me, before the Watergate break-in occurs. This is my ode to pre-public accountability America. Now everybody's blogging, podcasting, muckraking. I wanted to go back and write my own version of the facts.
You've got a blend of fictional characters in here from some from previous works. You've got the kind of the right-wing enforcers like Dwight Holley and Wayne Tedrow, and they're cheek by jowl with historical figures like Nixon, J. Edgar Hoover, Howard Hughes. Which of those true-life characters did you find the hardest to find a voice for?
They were all easy to find voices for. Nixon is the most original of the voices. In truth, when he was half gassed, he was funny. Surprisingly, I made him likable in the book.
Do you find that you like him looking back on him? Is he someone that you have got affection for?
I like him because I turned him into a good character. Would I have liked him as a human being? Probably not.
And yet, with all the mob hits and conspiracies that we find in this book, it struck me as one of your most perhaps hopeful and redemptive stories.
God bless you. This is my book about love is redemption, God, dialectic, conversion of belief. It's the story of a young lost boy who falls into a society of strong, politically motivated women, something I've never done before.
It also seems to suggest an uneasy truce between the far-right enforcers and the politics of the new left. Is that something that you were interested in? Do you see that as a character of the age?
No. No, I was in love with a far left-wing woman. It went bad. I'm not left-wing in the least. I wanted to honor the relationship. The relationship tanked early in 06. I couldn't have written the book without her.
This is the character of the Red Goddess, Joan Klein, who's one of your, I guess, strongest female characters. And so it is. She is based on a real person.
Real person named Joan, yeah.
What does Joan make of this?
Joan and I haven't spoken in several years. The woman Erica, who I consider to be the Joan Slayer, the woman who I will be with for the rest of my life, actually thinks Joan Klein is the weakest character in the book.
But she would say that.
I'd be disappointed if she didn't.
You were saying that the era covered in Bloods Are Over is one that you can remember, that you lived through. What are your own memories, then, of those years? I guess you were, like, in your early 20s at the time.
I was bombed out of my gourd, for one thing. I looked around me. I saw history. I was too self-absorbed to notice much anything. I was a panty sniffer. I was a prowler. I was a peeper. I was a dipshit. But I was looking around, and I was assimilating. And I was always telling myself stories in my head, and I always wanted to write novels. So one day, I just got up the juice and did it. I've been going strong for 30 years.
You're saying, though, that this latest series is a retreat, a conscious retreat from your previous crime books. Does that imply that you were starting to feel pinched by that label?
I wanted to do something bigger, different. I wanted to go deeper.
The other sense that I have from the trilogy is perhaps your feeling that maybe today's America is more domesticated, less primal, and maybe less, it provides less fertile ground for fiction. Do you think that that's the case? Are you ever drawn to write about the America of now?
I will never write another novel that goes beyond 1972. I deliberately insulate myself from the culture. I don't have a cell phone, a computer, a TV set. I don't read newspapers, watch television, or go to movies.
Why?
I want to live inwardly with a very few people, insulated from the world at large, from the rush of imagery, from anything that might distract me from my purpose of writing big historical novels.
So now it's done. Where do you go from here? I heard a rumor that you were interested in the Harding presidency next. Is that true?
That rumor is incorrect. Next year, Random House UK will publish my memoir, The Hilliker Curse, subtitled My Pursuit of Women. After that, I will go back to another bygone era of American history and write an even bigger quartet of books. That's all I'm saying about it.
James Elroy talking to Zan Brooks. Blood's a Rover is published by Century and is available at guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Now, we move on from the sublime to the ridiculous, and I'm sure our next author won't be offended by that. He's Philip Ardar, and the first volume of his new series, Grubtown Tales, this week won the Roald Dahl Funny Prize. And earlier this year, Phil dropped in to read a bit of it as part of our Hay Festival coverage.
Manuel Org was repulsive. How repulsive? I'll tell you how repulsive Manuel Org was. He once entered a competition to find the most repulsive person in the area at the time, and he was disqualified for being too repulsive. Would I lie to you? Except for money. You know how people go on about greasy hair? Well, Manuel Org's hair was so greasy that it was more grease than it was hair. So it'd be more accurate to have called it hairy grease than greasy hair. You'd probably go, yerch, and run a mile away from him as fast as your little legs or wheels would carry you. It's hard to imagine anyone having such hairy grease on top of their head. And what a head. Have you ever seen a really rotten potato? One that's been forgotten about and left to do its own thing? You have? Well, what an exciting life you must lead. Do write and tell me about it. On second thoughts, don't. I don't want you to. If you do, I'll simply look at your letter, sneer at it, like I do a little worthless piece of cheese, then put it in a pile marked ignore and hope that it might go away sooner rather than later. Manuel Org's head was like a rotten potato. It was lumpy, it was brownish yellow or yellowish brown, depending on which direction you were approaching him from, and it was knobbly. If it had been raining for a while, Manuel Org often had little green shoots growing out of his ears. When the weather was really hot, the grease poured from his head, running into the melted wax dripping from his ears, and they combined to form something which looked like the evil half-brother of golden syrup. Stay back! This is the gooey liquid of nightmares, and I should know. I've had a few bad dreams about it myself.
Philip Ardar reading from Grubtown Tales for our podcast from the Hay Festival earlier this year. With me in the studio to discuss the book and the significance of the Roald Dahl Prize are Julia Eccleshare, our children's books editor, and Sarah Crown, my opposite number on the book's website. Welcome, both of you.
Hi.
Hello.
Julia, first of all, tell us about the Roald Dahl Prize. It's quite new, isn't it?
Well, when Michael Rosen became the Children's Laureate, he had a lot of good ideas, and one of them was to set up a prize for funny books, because he'd always felt that they were sidelined by the major awards. Funny books just do not win prizes. They get onto shortlists. And we have to say it with the Guardian Children's Book Prize, Andy Stanton, who was last year's winner of the Funny Book Prize, was indeed shortlisted for our prize, but he didn't win. So I think Michael Rosen had a point. There were some of us who thought that rounding up humour was quite difficult, because it's actually a very varied category. It's all called funny books, but there's lots of different kind of funny. Anyway, it was one of Michael's ambitions as Children's Laureate. And very sensibly, the way ahead for this prize was to work with the Roald Dahl Foundation, who very generously sponsored it. So it was set up last year, and this week was the second award of the prize. And it's making a difference.
And Andy Stanton actually won the first one.
Yeah, last year Andy Stanton won. And, I mean, I think we do take credit at The Guardian for having put him on our...
But what's the book that he won it with?
He won it for the Mr. Gum series. That was his first book. So for him, it was an incredible thing to win a major award with his first book. And it wouldn't probably have won, well, it didn't win any other major prize.
Is Philip Ardar a good winner?
Yeah, I think he's a brilliant winner. I mean, they are extraordinary books. I mean, adults just would not read them. In fact, I think adults would find them very difficult to get into, because the humour is largely about disgusting. And it's a quite interesting kind of thing that children like disgusting, maybe because they're all the time, in a sense, that the funny person is often quite childlike in these situations. Mr. Gum is quite childlike in Andy Stanton's books, because he does all the things that other people don't like. And I think children spend a lot of their time being told that their characteristics are quite unlikable. So it's quite nice to shove all that off onto somebody else who actually is heroic because of how they do deal with their disgustingness. They become kind of heroic through being disgusting.
Mm. It's got the sell line, stinky rich and just plain stinky, which I couldn't see selling it to me. Would it sell it to you, Sarah?
It's unlikely, but I can definitely imagine quite a few 10-year-olds who would buy something on the strength of that.
And it brings us to the teen fiction that always puts me off terribly, like Louise Renison's books, the most recent of which is called Are These My Bazoomers I See Before Me? That's a different kind of awful, isn't it?
But it's exactly. I mean, it's the something about being kind of embarrassing and it being expressed, the embarrassment kind of being expressed. And I think children like that. But adults, on the whole, do not like funny books for children. I mean, adults have such a kind of improving view about what reading for children should be. They kind of like humour in picture books. I mean, everyone understands that Quentin Blake is funny and, you know, that's all right. But I think when it gets to reading, parents expect children to be reading something quite serious. And what they don't take into account is that actually a funny book can have quite a serious message, or a very serious message.
Mm. Do you think this is an issue in adult books, Sarah?
In the sense of funny books being overlooked?
Yes, not being valued as highly as they should be.
I think it's, I suppose that when you get to, when literature turns from children's literature to adult literature, humour becomes a genre like SF or fantasy or crime. It's perceived as a separate category. It's not literary. It's off on its own. And I imagine that people who write that sort of book find all of the frustrations that everyone who writes genre fiction has, which is, you know, we never get shortlisted, you know, we never win prizes. The book always goes to a literary book and not to a genre novel, which is, you know, every year everyone gets cross about that on the internet and bemoans the state of the judges. But
there has been established a prize for comic novels, hasn't there, which is the Woodhouse Prize.
That's right, to give it its full name, it's the Bollinger Everyman Woodhouse Prize.
And the prize is a pig, isn't
well,
it,
actually,
or something ridiculous?
The prize is threefold. You win a case of champagne, Bollinger, presumably. You win all 52 volumes of the Everyman Woodhouse, because they've reprinted all of P.G. Woodhouse's novels in these beautiful hardback, they're really gorgeous things. And then, in honour of one of Woodhouse's most famous fictional creations, The Empress of Blandings, what happens is you get a Gloucester Old Spot pig named after the novel that wins the prize. They used to do this thing where it's announced at the Hay Festival every year, and it used to be this amazing photo opportunity that you'd have they'd have the pig there, and then they'd have the author in the pen with the pig, and so it always got into the paper because it was just, you know, kind of author horsing around with pig. But unfortunately, I think it was, whether it was foot and mouth or just general health and safety or what, I can't remember, but for some reason they can now no longer do it's transportation, I think. They can't bring the pig there, so sadly one of the great selling points has gone.
I was looking at the list of past winners, and they're very serious writers.
They
it's
are.
People like Will Self, Jonathan Coe. Now, Jonathan Coe, he has won the Impact, but he's never won the Booker or the Costa or anything like that.
No, which is weird, because he's of such a stature and so widely known that you sort of think, you assume that he has, but actually he hasn't. And then, yes, I suppose kind of straight-up comic writers like Jasper Ford have won. Marina Levitska, she won for A Short History of Tracts in Ukrainian, which was shortlisted for the Orange Prize in, I think it was 2005. Mm-hmm. But didn't win it. And then this year, Jeff Dyer won for Jeff and Venice and Death and Varanasi.
Yeah, I never think of him as a particularly comic writer.
No, but he is. I guess that's the thing, though, isn't it? That's sort of the point of it, is that it's bringing it out of the genre and saying people can be funny, but we don't have to call them comic writers, that you can recognise humour in writing without it being sort of put off in a corner somewhere.
Julia, do you think that these prizes, the Roald Dahl Prize, will become a major fixture in the year, or do you think it's an also prize? Also,
no.
As well as the Carnegie, there is...
No, I think it's going to be a very major prize because, I mean, the Carnegie is a paramountly important prize. I mean, it's very difficult because a prize like that's got such history. You know, anybody will want to win something that C.S. Lewis and Arthur Ransom and, you know, it's difficult not for that not to be a kind of very major force. But I think the Funny Prize will become a big player because it is going to be a prize that children really enjoy, and it is going to be something that encourages more publishing. There's nothing like having a prize for making people want to publish for it. And so I think it will strengthen the publishing of funny books. One of the things about funny books that's quite difficult, I think, is they're often very time-specific. I mean, of course, yes, we can all think of lots of funny books that have lasted, and I think it's interesting that the adult Prize is based on Woodhouse. But we also know that humour is very specific to its time. And that's obvious if you look at telly, serials, whatever. So in a way, what's very good about this is it's going to encourage very contemporary publishing, but make it last by giving it this recognition.
Do you think that Roald Dahl is very contemporary to his time? He, of course, famously didn't win any prizes in his lifetime.
Well, exactly. I mean, he did. You see, he always won all the awards voted for by children. He won the Children's Book Award repeatedly. But even what I think, you know, is not a funny book but it's just a wonderful book, Danny Champion of the World, never won a major award, which is kind of quite surprising. But I think he was always called subversive. And, of course, as soon as you're a subversive writer, you are very close to the children's heart, but you're a very long way from the adult's heart.
Mm. Well, that, of course, could go for Will Self and Howard Jacobson, two winners of the Woodhouse Prize, wouldn't it? Well, as Willy Wonka himself once said, a little nonsense now and then is relished by the wisest men. Sarah and Julia, thank you very much for coming in. Philip Ardar's Grubtown Tales, published by Faber, and you can get them from guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Finally, Bettina Gapper is the one short story writer to have made it through to the shortlist of this year's Guardian First Book Award. The 13 stories of An Elegy for Easterly deal with sickness and corruption of Gapper's birth country, Zimbabwe, but also with the resourcefulness and the humour of the people who have to live there. She came into the studio to read a story which was described in the Guardian Saturday Review as an absolute gem, clever, beautifully crafted and very, very funny.
When the prices of everything went up 97 times in 1 year, Mudara Vitalis Mukaro came out of retirement to make the coffins in which we buried our dead. In a space of only 6 months, he became famous twice over as the best coffin maker in the district and as the Mpandawana dancing champion. Fame is an elastic concept, especially in a place like ours, where we all know the smells of each other's armpits. Mpandawana, full name Gutu Mpandawana Growth Point, is bigger than a village, but it is not yet a town. I have become convinced that the government calls Mpandawana a growth point merely to divert us from the reality of our present squalor with optimistic predictions about our booming future. As it is not even a townlet, a townling, or half a fraction of a town, there was much rejoicing at a recent groundbreaking ceremony for a new row of Blair toilets when the district commissioner shared with us his vision for town status for Mpandawana by the year 2065.
Tina Gapper reading the Mpandawana Dance Champion from her short story collection, An Elegy for Easterly. By the time the shortlist was announced, she'd returned to her home in Geneva, so we telephoned her there to find out some more. Have you written a lot more stories than this? Did you have a huge range to pick from?
Yes, I had 22 stories.
And how do you put together a story? How do you select the ones that you put in for a collection?
Well, you know what happened was this collection was purely an accident when my agent, Claire, said to me, why don't you pick the stories that you think fit together. So I picked about 15 stories. Yeah, there were 15 or 16 stories. And then my editors and I went back and forth. And in the end, I think I chose the stories that I felt were the strongest of the ones that I'd written. And there are some that I'm still working on now that I may publish at a later stage.
Our man in Geneva wins €1 million. I really love that.
Do you know, Claire, I mean, people say to me that's the most implausible story in the whole book, but actually that's the story that is the most true. Because it actually happened to somebody I know, even down to the emails. A diplomat I know here in Geneva, who was not from Zimbabwe, I should hasten to add, had this happen to him, and he was conned by Nigerians in Amsterdam.
Now, you don't only talk about black Zimbabweans, do you? You also talk about Indian Zimbabweans. Tell me a bit about Mr. Vaswani.
Mr. Vaswani really came to me because he's such an archetypal character, the Indian storekeeper in Africa. And I grew up going to a shop called NB, which is a shop that sells school uniforms. And I remember this shopkeeper who was always he always looked very busy, even though he actually wasn't doing anything. He would just be ordering people around to fetch down school uniforms and so on. And I began to think a lot about race relations in Zimbabwe in terms of, you know, what if you were neither black nor white? What if you were somewhere in between? What would life look like for you if you were in that middle? So I was just fascinated by that point of view, and I created this character, Mr. Vaswani.
So it's a sort of post-colonial picture, isn't it, but seen through these very particular characters. And, of course, there's also a very grim story underlying a lot of them. Well, a dual story. One is this massive inflation and economic collapse, and the other is AIDS.
This is where I think I hit on the right medium, which is the short story, because I had tried to write several novels, in fact. I tried to write a novel about the death of everything, you know, the death of justice, the collapse of the rule of law, inflation, the death of agriculture, AIDS. But I just couldn't make it sound true. It read like a political tract. So then I thought, well, let me step back and just take little bites of the larger cake, if you like. And what I ended up with were stories that allowed me to look at specific issues. And AIDS, yes, it is a theme that runs through, but it's not necessarily the main subject in each of the stories. It's really the subject, I think, in only one of the stories.
And what about economic collapse? It becomes a subject of comedy, doesn't it? It's almost like a riff. You know, you pay for a taxi ride with 3 million...
Well, you know, everybody jokes about the humor in the stories, but I suppose it's because they don't really know many Zimbabweans who are just incredibly funny people despite all the hardships they've been living under. And I think it's precisely because of the political repression and the hardships that there have been many political jokes and much political humor. Mm-hmm. I think it was Orwell who said that the political joke is a sort of a tiny revolution. Well, we've had thousands of tiny revolutions in Zim, and one of the things that people laugh about the hardest is the rate of inflation. It's ridiculous. I mean, at one point it was 500 million percent per annum or something like that. And what effectively happened is that the price of something changed on your way to the till to pay for it. I mean, that's a deeply comical situation.
How have the stories gone down in Zimbabwe? Is there a bit of resistance to seeing it in this way?
You know, by and large, people have been just very happy. I did have a nasty book review in The Herald, which is the state daily newspaper. But I think it had the effect of actually of people wanting to actually read the book. So it helped a little bit, if you like. But for the most part, people have been very positive and have reacted very well to the stories.
So now you work as a lawyer. You have a day job, don't you?
Yes.
How have you managed to fit in being a writer with that? Has that informed what you write about?
Well, I think it's made me a better writer in that I now know that writing is not about coming up with a perfect thing at the first attempt. You have to revise and revise and revise. And that's how we work here. And I'm also very good at being edited because, you know, the way we work here is that, you know, you don't really own the text. You're part of a team. The difficulty really is finding the time to write. And I've hit on writing every day and writing first thing in the morning before I go to work.
You also have a child, don't you? That must be hard.
Yes, I have a son. He's not that hard. He's 5 years old. He's reaching a stage where he can entertain himself, so it's not that hard. I think that the idea is to just really get a rhythm, and I've managed to do that, and that rhythm is working for me so far.
And is that rhythm particularly suited to the short story?
Do you know, I think it is. I hope people at Faber aren't listening to this, but I've actually discovered that I really want to write more short stories. I will write, you know, novels, you know, possibly two or three, but I really do want to write more and more short stories.
And in terms of your personal heroes as writers, do you include short story writers?
Oh, yes. I'm absolutely in love with Mavis Gallant. She's a Canadian writer who lives in Paris, has lived in Paris all her writing life. And she just has the most incredible stories about the kind of life that I live here, which is the kind of life where you're sort of disconnected from where you're from, but you're not quite connected to where you are. And so I just love her stories. And she's just a really gifted writer. I also greatly admire Alice Munro. Mm-hmm. And of course, Chekhov is one of my all-time favorite writers.
An Elegy for Easterly is published by Faber. The winner of the 2009 Guardian First Book Award will be announced on December the 2nd, and we'll hear from another of the authors on next week's programme. But that's all for now. Thank you to our guests Bettina Kappa, James Elroy, Zan Brooks, Sarah Crown, and of course Julie Eccleshare. I'm Claire Armistead, and this podcast was produced by Scott Corley. Goodbye.